equivalent electrical leg. The actual physical leg of a half-wave dipole antenna to obtain resonance at a certain frequency must be somewhat shorter than the actual measured half-wave length in space because of what is known as the end effect. Now, the end effect, by the way, is the you visualize little capacitors. It's capacitively coupled. All antennas are capacitively coupled into space. So that coupling actually changes its electrical length to a certain degree. So you have to compensate for that by compensating the physical length, making up for that end effect phenomenon that occurs. They show a little diagram here of the little capacitors, depending on the size of the dipole. You know, you can have depending on the diameter of the wire that you're making up, the dipole will determine, you know, the end effect capacitors, how many there are. The capacitors are all in power with each other. And as you know from your capacitor formula, when you put two capacitors in parallel, you're increasing the capacity, as opposed to two inductors in parallel, just the opposite. You take two resistors, take two resistors, put them in series, you're going to increase the resistance. Put two in parallel, you're going to decrease the resistance. So capacitors in parallel increase, and depending on the thickness of the conductor of the dipole will determine the end effect capacity at both ends, or one end. So they show it here in a diagram. The ends of the antenna have a capacitive linkage to space, which has the effect of loading or lengthening the antenna electrically. This end effect depends on both the frequency and the diameter and the shape of the antenna. And again, it's what I just described, and it's showing here in this diagram. All right. When the length of the antenna is very much greater than its diameter, which is more than 500 to 1, that's a big ratio there. So the length of the antenna is obviously going to be a lot longer than what the diameter is. The antenna is referred to as a thin dipole, and the amount of end effect is not as great as for a thick dipole, which has less than a 500 to 1 ratio. So that's just information. So if you want to, there's a thin dipole and there's a thick dipole. I think most of us are using thin dipoles. So they give you the example here. And so, for example, the length of a very thin dipole operating at a very low frequency might be 0.98 of the free space wavelength. So it's like, it's not one wavelength, it's 0.98 wavelengths, it's a little bit less, while a thick dipole might be only 0.94 of the frequency of the free space wavelength. So again, because of the end effect, it's not exactly one wavelength, it's less than that, it's a decimal point number, 0.9 something. So they just use that as an example of what the end effect does. So, it says now, let us see how much the end effect influences the length. And this will be interesting because how many people have antenna analyzers and want to adjust their antenna, make sure that it's resonant. It says, you already know that to find the wavelength of a signal, you divide the frequency of the signal into 300 million meters. And that's the actual speed of the frequency, 300 million meters per second, 186,000 miles per second, whichever way you want to look at it. So, for example, if the wavelength of a 2-megacycle signal, I shouldn't say if, let me repeat that. For example, the wavelength of a 2-megacycle signal is 300 million divided by 2 million equals 150 meters. And that's a full wavelength. Now you want to make a half wavelength because you want to make a half wave dipole. So thus, a half wavelength is 75 meters. 75 is half of 150. However, since we are more used to working in feet and miles than in meters, we must convert the figure to an English system of units. Well, this was back 20, 30 years ago when they wrote this, and how many people know their meters as opposed to feet? Because we all work in, even myself, you know, it's hard to convert to meters. Even our speedometers in our car are giving kilometers rather than, rather than miles per hour. You always have to convert. I think it's, Roy, what is it? Is it, if I'm not mistaken, I think it's 3.28 feet per meter, or around that mark. Is that right?
It's about 3.28.
See, I know my football. Okay, because football, they play in yards. Okay, 3.28. That's what I said. I remembered something.
Indeed, a lot of people will still use feet, no matter what you do.
Just repeat that? I didn't get it. Repeat?
No matter what you do, people are still going to want to use feet here in the United States.
Well, including myself, it's not easy to convert back and forth. Okay, so continuing, as I just said, so the half wavelength is 75 meters. However, since we are more used to working in feet and miles than in meters, we must convert this figure to the English system of units. There are approximately 39.4 inches in a meter. Does that make sense? 39.4, because it's 3.28 feet. There's 12 inches in a foot, 12, 24, 36. Yeah, I guess that's about right. So we're doing a little math here. So they're approximately 39.4 inches in a meter. So if we multiply 75 by 39.4, we can convert 75 meters into inches, and then divide by 12 to convert it to feet. So we get, the wavelength now will be 75 meters times 39.4 divided by 12 equals 246 feet. So that will be the full wavelength, not half, full wavelength of a dipole at 75 meters. How many people have property sizes that can handle the 246 feet of cable? You know, from end to end. Not too many. Luckily, we can get by having that. Having that would be, half wavelength, which would be efficient for the antenna to work. So, that's approximate, 246 feet. So we can eliminate the need of going through all this calculation every time we want to determine the length of a half wave by dividing 300 million by 2 to get 150 million. That's because it's half wave, it's not full wave. So we let it drop. We then simplify the expression further by dividing by a million and then expressing the frequency in megacycles instead of cycles. Finally, by multiplying 150 by 39.4 and dividing by 12, we set the formula up to get the length of a half-wave antenna in feet. That's in feet. The formula is 492 divided by frequency in megacycles. And we've seen this formula many times. It's in the AWRL handbook. It's all over the place. 492 is a standard number. So that's how they get that number, and I'm sure most of you out there have seen that number before. WATCO. Okay, we're almost done with this, if everyone has understood what I said so far. So, let's see, 492. So, thus, the half wavelength in space actually we're running at 2 megacycles. I said 75 meters, silly, because that's 3 megacycles. This is even a longer. I must have missed that. It says, thus, a half wavelength in space at 2 megacycles, for example, is 246 feet. 246, so that's 492 divided by 2 equals 246 feet. So this is actually a 2 megacycle frequency they're talking about here, approximately. Yeah, it's actually because I divided to get 150 meters, it was 300 million divided by 2 billion, which is 2 megs. Yeah, so. They call it 75 meters before. I saw it said that, but it's actually a lower frequency than that. 75 meters is 3 megs. This is around 2 megs, so it's longer. Anyway, I just confused everybody, so that's okay. One more thing, and then we'll wrap it up. It says here if the physical length of the antenna is made to correspond to this value, its electrical length would be too long, and it would not resonate at the desired frequency. Okay, because, again, remember I mentioned the end effect. The correction factor used for most antenna types is 0.95. Consequently, the corrected formula becomes, so now you got to multiply the whole thing by 0.95 of that wavelength. So it's 492 divided by 0.95, divided by the frequency, which corresponds to the other formula, which I'm sure you've all seen, 468. That corresponds to that end effect, capacitively coupled, that I was talking about earlier. So they compensate for that, and that's where they get this other number from. So, when we use this formula, we find that the physical length of a half wavelength dipole, which will resonate at 2 megacycles, is 234 feet, which is 468 divided by 2, which is 234. Thus, or I should say, this is 12 feet shorter than a half wavelength in space, which is 246 divided by 234, which is 12 feet. Okay. Okay, so if I confused everybody, I'm sorry. That'll do it for now. The rest of it, again, try to convey this information to hopefully get an overall picture of what I was talking about in resonance of dipole antennas and so on. Very elementary, very little math, but easy to digest, and that's what I'm hoping for. Then the next chapter, which is pretty long, will talk about the impedance of the antenna itself. So I guess we got, 20 to 10, so. Give it back to you, Roy. And so far, the repeat is holding up. I'm hearing myself fine. 21 watt. Way back to you, and thanks for letting me in again. This is Andy's Corner, WATCDL. Go ahead, Roy.
Thank you very much, Andy. This is AC2GS, hopefully getting through on the UHF repeater. And thanks for that talk. I just want to point out to the audience that if you absorb any part of what Andy was trying to convey to you about end effect, you now have a better understanding of antenna theory than the antenna editor of CQ Magazine. He's published a few very strange articles suggesting something other than end effect. But I thank you, Andy, for this episode. I look forward to next week's episode. I just want to give a little bit of a historical footnote. The 468 divided by frequency originated probably before a lot of this interesting knowledge was figured out. Back in something like 1928, the ARRL handbook found this number experimentally. They built a bunch of dipoles, and they looked to see when they were resonant, and they did the math, and they came up with the magic number 468 at the time. They knew a great deal about electrodynamics and electrical theory. Maxwell and everyone had written it all out, but that's how they said they came up with the 468 back in the 20s. And it still works reasonably well. Don't expect it to be perfectly resonant. You might need to tweak it because, it's based upon, all this stuff is based upon free space. And we all don't put our antennas in free space. We put them very close to the planet Earth. So keep that in mind. So once again, thank you very much, Andy. Does anyone have any further questions, either radio technology or any technology or, any subject? Otherwise, I'll do a couple of little stories from the Science Talk segment. Yes, David.
I'm going to switch to plane view. Hold on. This is. Is my signal okay?
You're rather noisy. I could make out what you're saying.
Is this better?
This is much better.
Thank you, Roy. Yeah, I'm sending my signal to UHF repeater. Hope you're all having a great evening. Dr. Roy, do you have any updates on the COVID situation? I know in New York there's some new, when a person wants to be eligible for a COVID vaccine, you know? Maybe you can update that because I...
Yes, David, you're quite right. New York State set up previously, if you were 65 years or older, you could schedule, if you could find a facility that has a supply for vaccination. My understanding is, effective next week, they're going to broaden it to people with complications that might make COVID-19 infections much more dangerous. Basically, diabetes, asthma, any kind of pulmonary disorder, any immunodisorder, cancers, recent immunotherapies and such. So there's a long list of complications. My best suggestion is to look up the health, New York State's health web-based thing, and they'll give you the list. You'll have to provide some kind of proof, no doubt, that you suffer from any of these ailments, and you can too schedule yourself along with the people over 65 years of age.
QSL, Roy, thank you very much. I'm there 100%.
Okay, very good, David. They're widening out. I actually have a little story on COVID-19. Basically, the premise is that the 46 million Americans over the age of 18 have already gotten one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine, and many have gotten their second dose. The numbers are going down. It doesn't mean that it's all over. It means that, Christmas and New Year super spreaders have had their effects and they've dissipating. And as the community becomes immune through vaccinations, the incidence will drop down further. There might be variants that pop up that are not quite as the vaccines are not quite as effective, but even if they're not effective for infection, they appear at this point, research, to be effective for morbidity and mortality. So that's a good thing as well.
Oh, go ahead, Dr. Roy. I'm listening.
Roy here, with the Limoss Technical Med. Anyone else has any further questions of any kind of technical, scientific topic, please let loose.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Just one comment and one question. The comment is, on the news they said they went from around 140,000 infections per day. Now they're roughly about half of that. They said 75,000 infections per day nationwide. And then a question is, have you heard anything about what happened to Johnson & Johnson? I thought they were supposed to be, you know, on the market by now. They got slowed down in the FDA, I guess. I thought that would have been out. But I haven't heard any updates. I listen to the news a lot, and I haven't heard anything about that.
Yeah, I haven't heard anything either. There's always rumors, unfortunately, which are very difficult to figure out if they're real or imaginary. There were rumors earlier on about Johnson & Johnson not quite ready to run up the production numbers. I don't know what to make of that. But, yeah, it still seems to be kind of stuck someplace with the Food and Drug Administration. They have yet to make their announcement. I don't know if they're having a problem with documentation or what's going on at their end.
Oh, okay. I know they have the one shot and you're good to go. So that would be good. You know, I don't care. I'll go anywhere. But, you know, that sounds good.
KC2R1.
The big benefit in a one-shot deal, you'll get a lot more people who will actually, they'll do it once and then it's done. There's going to inevitably be a number of people who take a first shot, and when it comes time for the booster, something's going to happen. They're going to either forget or decide that one's enough for them. It does elicit a degree of immunity. It probably does not have the same percentage of efficacy as with the booster, and it may not last as long in their immune system as if they took a booster. But it's kind of inevitable for anything that's more than a one-shot deal that there'll be people who don't go for the second shot. So any way of lessening that by a equally efficacious vaccine at the one-shot deal would be beneficial for people. As it is, thankfully, they've kind of upscaled the production. They've made agreements to kind of squeeze the supply. If you use a certain type of syringe, apparently, there's an over volume in each vial, so you can extract one more dose. So they're going to play something with that. So so far, so good.
Oh yeah, I agree. The news lately is better. There was another station just as we were starting to talk again. I don't know who it was. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, if there's a station out there, please ID.
KG2RY. Roy, I have a question for you. Israeli researchers have determined that the Pfizer vaccine is extremely effective according to their study. Did you hear about that?
I did not hear about the Israeli study. They have been listing efficacy for both the Pfizer and for the Moderna at something like 95, which is an incredible number. It's having a less efficacy in places, though, like South Africa, that has the South African variant. So it unfortunately seems to be equally dependent upon what population you study. If you study and what time you've studied them. If you studied them before variants like the South African variant, the numbers look better. If you study them in South Africa during the onset of the South African variant, they don't quite look as good. And for people out there, I've mentioned my link page, roy.ac2gs.com. There's an excellent article that I've linked to that you might have access to through New York Times, which gives a thorough illustration and description of what these variants are and mean and how they interact and perturb the vaccine and immunological attacks.
Okay, thank you very much.
Has any questions or topics or comments you want to make? Now's as good a time as any.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
Alrighty, I got my first shot today, 5 o'clock this evening, the Pfizer. No side effects. A little soreness just starting up in the arm now. Not much at all. So far, so good. And I'm scheduled March 7th for the second one. So I feel pretty good about that.
Very good. You did the right thing. It is very important to become vaccinated. I realize that people are worried and conspiracies are all over the place, but the best approach we can all make, both to ourselves and to each other, is to become vaccinated and immunized. And as you mentioned, Lou, the primary symptoms that I have heard and I have experienced is a little ache in the injection site. But, you know, I mean, some people have more allergic symptoms than others. I have allergies, but I took an antihistamine before just to be on the safe side. But, soreness in your arm is primarily about it. The second booster shot, some people have reported some more severe inflammatory, you know, vague allergy-like symptoms because you're really kind of kicking your immune system the second time around. But, you know, it's for the most part, seems to be a very safe and effective vaccine, both the Pfizer and the Moderna.
Yeah, so, yeah, the second one could have a little bit more. I understand, might get a fever, chills, you know, for a day or two. And muscle ache, maybe a little nausea even. May happen in younger folks because their immune system is a little stronger, and the kick will be stronger. But so I guess I'm on the way here. So whatever, it's a day or two, you know, it's fine. Small price to pay if indeed that even occurs.
A little bit slower, please.
Sorry, KB2HHU, SIG.
Yes, SIG.
Just a note, and I'm in my early 50s, just so you know the age. I took about maybe almost 3 weeks ago the second dose of Moderna. I'm an EMT, so we got in on the early phases of the vaccination. And I can confirm on the second dose of Moderna, I did have a day with chills and, feeling not so great. It was kind of rough, but, it was just a day, and I felt fine after that. So a little bit of fatigue, but definitely the gentleman mentioned chills and stuff. It happened to me. Wouldn't hesitate to take the vaccination again, knowing that it's definitely worth going. But it did happen, just to confirm. KB2HHU.
Well, thank you, Sig. I understand that. That's, again, very common. Because you've already set up a degree. Your immune system knows that it's an enemy, and it's on the lookout for it. So that second shot is not going to lead to a progressive infectious process that's going to make things worse. So it pretty much, once it gets into your system and your immune system recognizes it, it kind of starts to attack immediately. And usually over the next day or so, things get better. It's much, much, much better than some of the presentations of the actual viral infection. So it's part of the nature of that second booster. another reason why, depending upon what Johnson & Johnson's results are, it might be easier to take for a lot of people than a dual, two-dose type of system. But thank you for adding that, Sig. I appreciate it.
No problem. KBQ-HQ.
Okay, once again, this is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra, Roy Hill with the King, with the Limark Tactical Net. So if you have any other questions or comments on this subject or any pertinent subject, please feel free. Okay, we'll go to a couple little science talks. We've already mentioned COVID-19, so I'll skip the stories about COVID-19. They're available on my link page. You can read them at your leisure. But I'll let it drop, and we'll talk about some other good medical news. Okay, about one-third of people who took a new drug for treating obesity lost more than one-fifth of their total body weight, according to a major global study involving UCL researchers. The findings from the large-scale international trial published recently in the New England Journal of Medicine is being hailed as a game changer for improving the health of people with obesity and could play a major part in helping the United Kingdom to reduce the impact of disease such as COVID-19, as well as the world and us included. The drug semaglutide works by hijacking the body's own appetite-regulating system in the brain, leading to reduced hunger and calorie intake. Rachel Batterham, professor of obesity, diabetes, and endocrinology, who leads the Center for Obesity Research at UCL and UCLA Centers for Weight Control Management, is one of the principal authors of the paper, which involves about 2,000 people in 16 different countries. Professor Batterham said the findings of this study represent a major breakthrough for improving the health of people with obesity. Three-quarters of people who received the semaglutide, 2.5 milligrams, lost more than 10% of their body weight, and more than one-third lost more than 20%. No other drug has come close to producing this level of weight loss. This really is a game-changer, she said. For the first time, people can achieve through drugs what was possible through weight loss surgery. Let me drop for a sec. Professor Batterham added also, the impact of obesity on health has been brought into focus by COVID-19, where obesity markedly increases the risk of dying from the virus, as well as increasing the risk of many life-limiting serious diseases, including heart disease, type 2 diabetes, liver disease, and certain types of cancer. This drug could have major implications for health policy for years to come. The average participant in the trial lost 33.7 pounds. This was accompanied by reductions in risk factors for heart disease, diabetes, such as waist circumference, blood fats, blood sugar, and blood pressure. The reported improvements in their overall quality of life. The trial's chief investigator, Professor John Wilding, said this is a significant advance in the treatment of obesity. Semaglutide is already approved and used clinically at lower dosages for the treatment of diabetes, so his doctors are already familiar with its use. For me, that's for him, this is particularly exciting as I was involved in early studies of the GLP-1 study. Let's see, we were the first to show in the laboratory studies that GLP-1 affected appetite. So it's good to see this translated into an effective treatment for people with obesity. With evidence from this trial, semaglutide has been submitted for regulatory approval as a treatment for obesity to the National Institute of Clinical Excellence and the European Medicine Agencies and the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. The phase 3-step randomized controlled trial involved 1,961 adults who were either overweight or had obesity problems, and took place in 129 sites in 16 countries across Asia, Europe, North America, and South America. Let me drop that. Anyway, participants took a 2.4 milligram dose of semaglutide or a matching placebo weekly via subcutaneous injection, similar to the way people with diabetes inject insulin.
Overall, 94.3% of participants completed the 68-week study, which started in autumn of 2018. Those taking part also received individual face-to-face or phone counseling sessions with registered dietitians every 4 weeks to help them adhere to their reduced calorie diet and increase physical activity, providing guidance, behavioral strategy, and motivation. Additionally, the participants received incentives such as kettlebells or food scales to mark progress and milestones. In those taking semaglutide, the average weight loss was 33.7 pounds with a reduction in BMI, if you know what BMI is, of minus 5.54. The placebo group observed an average weight loss of 5.7 pounds with a reduction of BMI of minus 0.92. Those who had taken semaglutide also saw reductions in risk factors for heart disease, diabetes, as I mentioned before, as waist circumference, blood fats, blood sugar, and blood pressure, and reported improvements in their overall quality of life. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2, any questions?
Yes, Lou.
John, I think I heard Paula there also. They would have to get these injections in the long term to keep the appetite suppressed?
My guess would be, unfortunately, yes. I mean, you might be able to stretch the dosages out, but my surmise is because of the way it works, it's easily reversible. If you stop taking, your appetite returns to your previous level, unless you've learned new habits and stabilized yourself. So kind of a maintenance dose is the best to recommend, and probably it would have to be a sliding scale based on an individual people's tendency to fall back to bad habits.
Limark TechNet tonight at 8 o'clock. This is the W2VL repeater.
All righty, very good. I think Paul might be in there.
That's right. Yeah, the question is, people are going to be injecting this. Is there a pill? Can they make a pill out of this down the road?
Well, the present drug doesn't really lend itself, as far as I'm aware. It's a subcutaneous injection. My guess would be that it's digested in stomach enzymes. So going down the stomach, they may end up, if it's a valuable thing for them to research, and I'm sure they're going to try to some degree to find if they can in some way protect it from digestion and somehow get it to a point of being absorbed into the bloodstream without enzymes breaking it up. But right now, as far as I'm aware, it's basically a subcutaneous injection technology.
Okay, understood. Thank you, Roy.
You're welcome, Paul. Any other questions on this particular topic? Okay, on to the next story. Astronomers first spotted the space rock that is now known as Apophis in 2004. It's precisely the sort of object that most humans probably want to know about. It's awfully big, and occasionally it comes uncomfortably close to the Earth. April 13th, 2029 is one such occasion when Apophis will skim so close to the Earth that it will pass through the realm of particularly high-altitude satellites. Scientists are excited. They've calculated just how rarely an object this large passes this close to Earth. Quote, this is something that occurs about once every 1,000 years, so obviously it is generating a lot of interest, end quote. Marina Borozik, a radar scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab in California, told Space.com. The March flyby won't be nearly as stunning as the 2029 close approach. Apophis will come only one-tenth of the average distance between the Earth and the Sun. that's more than 40 times as distant as the moon is from the Earth. But scientists have big goals for the Apophis 2029 flyby, and in order to get the most out of that opportunity, they need to know as much as possible about that space rock. And now, and next month, is their last real chance to study Apophis before the big day. Apophis in 2029 is going to be really incredibly observing opportunity for us, Porozik said, but before we get to 2029, we have to prepare. Like all near-Earth asteroids, Apophis has been rattling around the inner solar system for millennia, unnoticed by humans. Scientists believe it is more than 1,000 feet wide and around the height of the Eiffel Tower. It's a mix of rocks and metals, according to NASA, and may be shaped a bit like a peanut, two uneven lumps smushed together. Astronomers spotted Apophis for the first time in 2004. The asteroid's discovery is a perfect example of planetary defense, the task dedicated to spotting asteroids around the Earth, tracing their precise orbits and determining whether they pose any risk of hitting Earth. Forewarned is forearmed, so the theory goes, and scientists hope that if they can identify a large future impact without warning, humans can find a way to defend themselves. Let me drop for a sec. And for a brief moment, Apophis seems to run nearly 3% odds of colliding with the Earth on April 13, 2029. Even the best observations have some uncertainty, and the farther ahead in time an orbit is plotted, the more that uncertainty piles up. That early concern inspired its name, which refers to an ancient demon serpent who personified evil and chaos, as NASA put it. Some of Apophis's flybys are perfectly mundane, others quite close, but more precise observation pushes any collision fears first to 2036 and then to 2068, when scientists can't quite positively rule out a collision yet. Right now, Apophis is minding its own business, like thousands of other pieces of cosmic rubble, trekking around the sun every 323.6 Earth days. Hurtling through space, the asteroid's existence is utterly uneventful. 9 or so more loops around the sun for Apophis and 8 more for Earth will bring the objects just within about 19,800 miles. Scientists know that Apophis will not hit Earth this time, but depending upon precisely how the two rocks whiz past each other, Apophis may never look the same. The same gravity that keeps our mundane lives anchored to Earth's surface will tug at Apophis throughout the close encounter. Scientists think there's a chance Earth's gravity will be strong enough to scatter boulders on the surface of Apophis, or perhaps even stretch the asteroid out as if it was salt water taffy instead of rock. Let me drop for a sec. How dramatic the stretch will be depends upon a host of factors. First, the precise shape of Apophis, then its orientation during the flyby. If a broadside faces Earth, each patch feels less gravity. If a narrow head does, the asteroid is set up for a game of tug-of-war. Then what's inside? Solid, dense rock could resist Earth's gravity more than, say, loose clusters of smaller boulders would. Some of those characteristics scientists can study from Earth, but the interior of Apophis is impenetrable at this distance, except perhaps through the 2029 flyby. Quote, how Apophis itself responds, that's physically about how Apophis is put together, and that's something we don't know. We don't know how asteroids are put together. We've never been able to peer inside an asteroid, Binzel said. We see the asteroid outside looking in. This is a chance where we could have the asteroid inside looking out. In other words, is the inside of the asteroid revealing itself by some measurement we can make on the outside? It's an incredible experiment arranged purely by the coincidence of orbit. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
I have an unrelated question.
Okay, David, what's your unrelated question?
Well, what do you know about IP radios?
I would assume that IP means Internet Protocol, so you're talking about radios that rather than being transmitted through radio waves locally are embedded in packets in the Internet.
Well, it's sort of like D-Star DMR fusion, but without the hotspot, you know, without without the repeater, the HT, or the device that you're using, you know, it transmits either through a carrier, a cellular carrier, or Wi-Fi.
Yes, well, but there's many ways of approaching that. You're basically talking about what I'm doing right now, which is, well, I don't know if you're talking about one-way radio or two-way radio. I'm streaming this audio on the Internet, so people who've been technet.ac2gs.com are receiving an audio stream through the Internet protocol. So you can stream regular radio broadcasts. You can run your own series of musical or documentary audios, or you can stream two-way radio. I have a program called BlueDB. It uses an Ambi dongle. It connects to the servers that most people use for DMR and the others, like Brandmeister, purely over the Internet. There's no handy talkie involved. There's no digital handy talkie involved. It's a microphone and the sound of the PC, and you can communicate to different talk groups through this particular software.
QSL, I know about those two. You can do D-Star, Fusion, and PMR also through your computer with a computer mic and computer audio. I don't want to do that. I like to keep my computer free, you know, for HD digital audio. I like to keep music on most of the time. I guess what I was talking about was an IP radio that allows you to do PINA, Echolink, IRN, Zello, you know, a whole pile of different things. And you can play it through your Wi-Fi, or you can take it with you and run it through a cellular carrier. And the radios are inexpensive and they're small, and I think they play pretty good.
Well, for the most part, most of the people I know using all those have some kind of a smart cell phone, Android or iOS based. There are a couple of applications that don't cross over. The Peanut application, although the guy who writes the applications wrote one for PCs, he also wrote one that's very popular for Android. For some reason, he doesn't want to port it over to iOS, so it's not available on the iPhone. But almost pretty much all the applications that you mentioned are available at Google's store for the Android cell phone.
Yeah, but there's a big difference between a smartphone and one of these radio devices. Do you know what that difference is?
I do not know. Perhaps it is the price, or that you don't have to get a contract with a carrier.
Negative. The big difference between a radio that's specifically used for IP has a much bigger and fatter battery in it, and the battery, you know, will play much longer when you're listening and transmitting to these battery-hungry apps.
Okay, I don't really find them to be terribly battery-hungry, you know, especially if you use a headset and if you blank the screen, that's where a lot of the power goes. But, you know, different strokes for different folks. I have a cell phone. I have a battery, you know, rechargeable batteries that can plug directly into the USB connector and supply an endless amount of power. So, you know, whatever suits the individual.
QSL. Yeah, the IP radios, you know, they can run for quite a long time. Some of these applications that run on these radios are very, like, they consume batteries. And it's good to have a battery that's at least 4,500 to 5,000 milliamp hours and easily chargeable. And then the other thing about a smartphone is you can't take the battery out once it's completely depleted. You know, you have to go to the repair shop. These IP radios, you can take the battery out, put another one in.
Okay, well, as I've mentioned before, it's true that it has, most of them, unfortunately, have built-in batteries. Unless you are very adept, you might want to go to the different companies and swap them out and have to pay an extra fee. But again, you could also plug in an accessory battery, and that works. Like I said, I have, I think, three at this point. They can take something like, I don't even remember anymore, 15 to 20,000 milliamp hours or so, and that's a lot of power in a small, concise amount. Do you have any particular manufacturer's brand name IP radios that you've been looking at lately?
Let me see here. I have Uniwamp. I have Enrico. I have Anisecu. One called Hiltrand, but that one looks like an Anisecu. And these devices, you know, they have, like, one device could be of three or four brands. You have to look carefully at the specs.
Yeah, I would assume that these are Chinese devices. Often they're made in one single factory, and they're labeled with different brands because different other companies distribute and maintain them.
Well, you know, I recommend that if you buy one of these, get one that's made for the USA, and if you can buy one from a US vendor, I recommend that, and I know there are some U.S. vendors that sell the U.S. versions of these radios. And they also work, you know, as cell phones.
Okay, I tend to doubt, though, that it would be kind of accurate to say that they're U.S. versions. They're probably just relabeled. But you know, for the most part, the United States doesn't manufacture these type of things anymore. And if they did, they would cost a great deal more. So I would still kind of suspect that they're all primarily being manufactured in a Chinese factory and then just being rebranded.
No, negative. That's not what I meant. U.S. version, it's not made in the United States. But it means that it'll play on U.S. Cellular service, you know? If European version or U.S. version. You know, if you're in the United States, you want to get the U.S. version.
Yeah, that makes sense. How much do these things cost? I last time I even looked at any of these, they were kind of like, I don't know, $300 or something.
The one I have is $50. I got it on eBay refurbished. But you got to know how to set these up, you know? So you can get one, you know, they start at about $130, they go to about $400.
Okay, that's an option for people out there. I don't know, I have my cell phones. I even have old cell phones that are kind of slightly out of date, but they work well. They're not connected to a tower, they're just connected to my Wi-Fi and such, and I get by for my purposes, but that's another option for people out there. There's an almost infinite number of ways of communicating, and this device is yet another one.
Well, I think a big battery will give you longer life overall, you know, for the performance of the device, you know. And I know that certain smartphones also have bigger batteries, but they also cost a heck of a lot more, and I don't want to spend $800 on a smartphone.
Okay, and that's your option. These devices, though, have somewhat more limited capabilities. If they
fulfill the goals and, that you need, then they're perfect for you. But, you know, other people might need different variations on the theme. Some people like small, you know, cell phones. So a big phone or a big device with a big battery in it would just kind of weigh those people down. So, yeah, again, there's an infinite number of consumer items to benefit any taste.
Negative, Roy. It's a small device with a big battery, you know, and I want to get an inexpensive one just to play through the Wi-Fi for all the programs that this thing can provide. You know, my computer is reserved for other things.
Okay, once again, fine. If it works for you, then that's great. Again, different people might want different things, and, you know, each to their own.
It's like I said, you know, people got to know what they want, you know, in order to get it. And people, they struggle to know what they want, so you have to do your research.
Yes, indeed. Everyone should pretty much know what they need and what they want. It's coming up time for SpaceNet Report, David, but I appreciate you bringing this topic to us.
Thank you, Dr. Roy.
Okay, so once again, this is ACCGS, and I want to just remind you guys and gals the usual stuff. If you can't get on to the TechNet and you have a question, or if you have a topic you want to hear discussed, or if you have a puzzle you'd like to share so that I could share them with the audience out there, or if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at something space-related and comment on it, the email address to reach me is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. There's a link page. Once again, it has a lot of very interesting things. If you think that Andy's comment about explaining how electromagnetic waves radiate off of an antenna is complicated, I have an interesting YouTube that discusses the underlying basis for something called quantum field theory. It uses high school differential calculus, so don't be frightened. If you don't understand what the equations mean, just listen to the guy. It might give you a better insight into something that explains why electrons don't seem to have any dimensions. And there are a lot of other links available, so please take a look at that at your leisure. And also want to remind everyone that my KC2NJI has a wonderful archive of technical nets going back to September of 2006. And his site is amateurradio.tv. So keeping that all in mind, I, as always, want to thank everyone who participated tonight, and certainly Andy for Andy's Corner. And now I look forward to listening to Paul and the SpaceNet Report.
Very good, Roy. WS2N here for the SpaceNet Report, you know, for the TechNet. And by the way, Roy, your signal, very good throughout the whole night. You know, I hope we get it straightened out for next week, but if not, you're doing very good. Very good tonight, Roy.
Thanks, Paul.
Okay, very good. Yeah, first thing I wanted to mention was the club, Lima Club. We had a general meeting last Wednesday, and they had a presentation by Dr. Alex Young, Associate Director for the Science in the Heliophysics Science Division at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. And he gave a wonderful presentation on space weather or space phenomena dealing with the sun. The presentation had to do with all the satellites out there that are receiving now the corona mass ejections, when that happens on the sun, how it affects the ionosphere. Of course, it affects us, you know, with the HF. But terrific presentation. And, you know, again, he's from NASA, and he said someday in the future he would be back. But very well done by Limar. Let me drop it. So, okay. First thing I want to mention is the landing of Perseverance, the 2020 rover. So it's going to land in 2021. It took off in July of last year. It took all this time to get to Mars. But it will be landing on the 18th, which is this Thursday. Yeah, NASA coverage will start at 2:15, which is drop.